Hello, listener. Welcome to Switch, the podcast that has always been a huge fan of the Champions Trophy. The World Cup group stage is done with, and it's coming home, people. It being the plane carrying England's deposed champions after their attempts to defend slash attack their trophy ended in barely mitigated failure. What mitigation there was came in the last couple of games as Joss Butler's team squeezed into the top eight and thereby secured something almost as good as a trophy. Yes, that's right, qualification for the big one, the 2025 Champions Trophy in Pakistan, the prize we literally didn't know was on the offer when England flew out to India more than 6 weeks ago. Joining me in the studio to mark this proud achievement are ESPN Cricket Info UK editor Andrew Miller and assistant editor Vish Ehantharajah. Hello, chaps. Hope you weren't up too late celebrating. Miller, you're the authority here on England World Cup misery. It wasn't so bad in the end, was it?
Indeed, I ought to update my list of miserabilia. I mean, it is just the worst, isn't it? I mean, you know, for all that England ended on a relative high with two wins in a row, given the expectations going into the tournament, given, you know, most people assumed, because the format is geared towards the best teams getting to the top four, there was no way that England would be so bad they couldn't challenge for a fourth spot. And they were. And they were lucky to get seventh. I mean, that's extraordinary. It is really, really is the worst World Cup performance I've ever seen in any sport, given the expectations that they went in with. And I mean, you know, they did finish reasonably well, which, you know, also lends itself to everything we all thought about going into the tournament, how little 50 over cricket they played. By the time they played nine games in a row, they were just starting to get the hang of it, weren't they? It was, you know, maybe a little bit more practice of the 50 over game.
Maybe it should be all plays all twice.
Exactly, they'd be coasting home.
Another 5 weeks until the knockouts. Surely no one could complain. Vish, it only seems a few weeks ago that we were debating Harry Brook's place in the squad and England's golden generation going off to challenge for more silverware, which is because it was only a few weeks ago. But what's been your take on how the wheels came off?
I think, without going a bit, you know, insular, I did wonder in terms of how little one-day cricket they played in the cycle, and also maybe some of the talk from some of us in this room going into this World Cup about how the golden generation, you know, this is almost the perfect sign-off for them to defend what they started in 2019. Now, I appreciate it started a bit before that, but certainly I was of the view coming into this that, yeah, this just about makes sense. There'll be a bit of muscle memory there. They'd obviously come back off. They were coming off the back of the New Zealand series, so there's an element of, you know, going in what I thought was, you know, in a pretty strong position where everyone was playing their roles, and Stokes hit that 180 at the Oval and everything was looking rosy. But yeah, it was one of those. I would agree with Miller in terms of it being the worst of the worst, because not least because of the expectation, but I suppose more because of the arrogance. And I wouldn't even bestow that arrogance entirely on the team in the ECB per se, because I think for the last few years, perhaps maybe to justify the lean towards T20 cricket for individual players and coaches and whatever, we'd maybe talked ourselves around to the idea that actually T20 cricket, brilliant, they're all doing that. And for 50 over cricket, just extend it a bit and just fine. It's just an extension of your short format skills. And evidently it's not. In fact, that couldn't be farther from the truth, really, considering how a lot of the more successful teams have gone about their business in this World Cup, India included. So I think the worst part about it is maybe we should have seen it coming.
Yes, that's what we do this job for, isn't it?
Really? Yeah. It's so much easier in hindsight.
Don't go back and listen to everything we said 6 weeks ago. Let's do one last recap. England were already packing their bags by the time they lost a sickener to Australia to confirm they wouldn't be reaching the knockout stages. They did manage to hoist themselves off the bottom of the table by beating Netherlands and Pakistan fairly comfortably, it should be said. But we'll still be home in time to get started on some early Christmas shopping. Miller, Ben Stokes got his first World Cup 100 in Pune. But helping to beat Netherlands by 160 runs wasn't exactly what he came out of retirement for.
No, it wasn't. But, you know, in terms of the muscle memory we're talking about, Ben Stokes' World Cup was pure muscle memory, really, wasn't it? I mean, he had one horrid aberration in that 10-ball duck against India. But even then, when he tried to slog Mohammed Shami off a length to take on the game, he happened to take on the one ball that was hitting his stumps. All the others had been outside off. So right decision, wrong ball to choose by a distance, and he looked foolish. Thereafter, he produced two innings against Sri Lanka, I think it was, 40-odd, and then Australia, 60-odd. Both of them, while he was at the crease, you were thinking, Ben Stokes is at the crease. Mm. This is going to be okay, because Ben Stokes always makes it okay. And then finally, you get that 100. Similarly, bit of a panic situation after the middle order showed that extraordinary fallibility that we none of us predicted, England looking quite so lost when it comes to how to pace in innings. But out he comes, scores 100, and then 84 in the final game, when again, it looked like 100 was on the cards. It looked like he was going through the gears in the way that he does. He was back to what he does by the end of the tournament. Unfortunately, he missed those first two games. He took too long to find his range thereafter. It was 5-6 games into the tournament before Ben Stokes made anything resembling a telling contribution, and 5 games too late. So, you know, going back to your point, none of us saw this coming. I would argue we kind of did see it coming, but we came to the wrong conclusion. We were all talking about, we don't think England have done enough prep in 50-over cricket, but it'll be okay, won't it? You know, we'll be okay. We're sort of looking around and think, yeah, it'll be okay. I mean, they're world beaters. They know what they're doing. We basically took them on trust for this tournament. Thought, you know what, you haven't put in your prep for all sorts of reasons, but fair play, you've done the business playing baseball and all the rest of it. There've been perfectly valid reasons why England have not been focusing on 50-over cricket, not least winning the T20 World Cup. You know, that was another reason they didn't focus on 50-over cricket. So all of those reasons stacked up as good mitigating evidence as to why, okay, this is a bit weird. This is certainly not the preparation they went into 2019 with, but fine. Or we'll take them on faith for this tournament. And that faith just evaporated for all manner of reasons, which we'll get into just now. But, you know, Matt's written a long piece about it today, just blow by blow, all of the errors that were made all the way down from selection wobbles to central contracts to untimely injuries to dumb statements at the pre-match press, the captain's press conferences, all of these things.
Forgetting it would be quite hot in the middle of the day.
Hot in Mumbai or not even scouting out the fact that it could be quite hot, which is even worse. All of these little one percenters.
Ask someone who knows.
You'd have thought so, wouldn't you? But you
know, look out the window when you're there for the 3 days leading up to it. You know.
So all of these things stack up as mitigating reasons why, you know, we were willing to give them the benefit of the doubt, and then blow by blow by blow by blow, that lack of faith just engulfed them.
Yes, that is very much worth a read, all those little decisions and sort of the domino effect through the tournament. I mean, we obviously then start getting to the blame game. Who's at fault here? Vish, I think we talked on the last pod about Butler's captaincy and Mott as coach. And since then, we've heard from Rob Key. And, I mean, he spoke a couple of days ago, basically said, it's hard for me to be critical of Joss Butler and Matthew Mott when I'm the one who, every single time the decision has been made for whether or not we focus on 50-over cricket, Test cricket or T20, I've always chosen Test cricket. I mean, it's sort of a reversal of what happened in that period from 2015 to 2019 when ODIs went front and centre. And then, as Matt's article sets out, you know, in the gap since then, T20 is obviously pushed to the fore with those back-to-back World Cups. And it goes to that problem that all teams, perhaps apart from India, face of trying to compete in three formats which are all distinct. But I mean, does that, for a start, would you go along with that Mott and Butler deserve another crack at, well, it's another T20 World Cup, in fact, in 8 months' time or so?
Yeah, no, definitely I do. I do think that. In terms of blame, I think a lot of people are to blame, but it's not necessarily one person who shoulders most of it. Like, I thought it was quite generous of Rob Key to pin it on himself. And I suppose he can do that, not least because he's a very good operator. Like, his track record since coming in is exemplary, really. So he can afford to, you know, wear a few of the scuffs because it doesn't really, you know, distract from his body of work. And I think, you know, Matthew Mott, hearing some of his utterances out at the back end of that tournament, and Joss Butler, who just really, one of the things that has perhaps undermined his captaincy most of all is media engagements, in that he really doesn't like doing them. You do a lot as an England captain. There was a stage during the 100 actually where he, I know privately, was quite annoyed about how much he had to do. But the nature of that tournament being, well, you know, you're Jos Buttler, you're one of the stars. This is all for TV. This is kind of what it's about. And obviously that's taken its toll on him. And I suppose those two, as you mentioned before about, you know, the comments that we're not defending the World Cup, we're attacking it and mocked by the end of it. It kind of speaks to not really thinking about, I suppose, the media side of it, the spoken word, which to you might be inconsequential, but it's something that your predecessor, Owen Morgan, got right, absolutely nailed. And even Bayliss to an extent, because by the end, he was so aloof that you kind of could have a joke with him. Every time you chat to Bayliss about the one-day teams, oh, man, I don't know, it's all Morgan. And you know, that worked because they were winning, obviously. I think the one thing that I would say in terms of, yeah, obviously they will get the T20 World Cup next year. And if anything, the absurdity of the global T20 schedule, the fact that we've had one a year for the last 3 years, probably helps them because it gives them a little bit of insurance, and England should probably do quite well out there, even with a few new faces. I do think there's something to be said for Jos Buttler and his form. And I think maybe it's only with captaincy in ODIs that you probably realise just how much effort behind the scenes goes into his batting, because it's clear the distractions just throw him off a cliff. And I suppose maybe we can extrapolate that to his test performances that we've seen from him as well, not just the keeping side of it, but clearly the stress and strain of playing test cricket affected, you know, Jos Buttler at his explosive best. We never really saw that in test cricket. And a lot of that is situational, of course, but I think it's been stark how... I think the worst dismissal for me was chipping Adam Zampa to mid-off. It's a shot that if you think of Jos Buttler at his best, yes, there's, you know, all the fancy things behind the wicket, but it's actually just standing up and just booming a spinner out of the ground. And he looked like he was playing that as a, you know, someone with the strength of 50% of the usual Jos Buttler. And I think only he will be able to make that decision. Bear in mind that when he started his captaincy, he used the 100 in 2022 to captain away from the stumps. You know, Phil Sol, captain for Manchester Originals, and he specifically said, ahead of that 2022 World Cup, I don't actually know where my best position is as a captain, so I'm going to go in the outfield and try that. I think he might revisit that in some way, whether that's probably most likely from giving up the captaincy himself. But I suppose for the time being, at least, for the next year at least, I think it's important that he's in the role just to cultivate the next generation. Because it feels like we're in a similar situation with Root and the test captaincy, because it doesn't look like there's anyone else in that squad, really.
Ben Stokes.
That's a smart one.
It's so true. We joked about Root's captaincy of the test team being a bit of a hostage situation. And frankly, it feels a little bit like that for Buttler right now. He's the only one of the 2019 generation to be picked for this tour of West Indies, which in itself is not a massive surprise, because when England won the T20 World Cup, they then went to play that ridiculous series against Australia and binned off pretty much everyone who'd been involved. So, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that all of that generation are out of the picture. I mean, Mark Wood's got a 3-year contract, so presumably he's going to be in and around for a while yet. But yeah, it is extraordinary the extent to which his mental state fell off a cliff in this tournament. I mean, you look at the way, I think Barney Rone made the point in one of his columns that he had not played a single reverse sweep, scoop or ramp shot in the entire tournament going into that final game. When he finally did, he finally played a reverse sweep, went away for four, played another one and was dropped at backward point. I mean, he was just so far away from the domineering batter that we know. But we've also seen this. You touched on his test form. And, you know, the far away look in his eyes,
Someone wrote a piece about his eyes, I think.
But they're
happier times.
Yeah. Happier times, but, he looked lost in a way that is quite unbecoming of a captain, to be perfectly honest. He looked so personally bereft that it translated into his entire team was bereft. I mean, if you look at, you know, the two great poker face captains in English cricket of recent times, Owen Morgan and Michael Vaughan for me. I mean, you got Nasser Hussain was a great captain, but he was never poker faced. He was furious, you know. He was an angry man. Whereas Morgan and Vaughan had this ability, even when things were going wrong, you look, the camera pans to you, captain, mm-hmm. and you're cool as a cucumber. And that can only translate into your team. If you look as though you personally are completely bereft, as Butler was throughout that tournament, that surely has a knock-on effect on the team that you're trying to skipper out in the middle there. So it is a worry. And we saw this when his test form fell off a cliff in the Ashes. He looked unselectable by the end of the Ashes, and he's never played test cricket again. I suppose the one flip side to that is the speed with which he was able to turn it around when he got into a different scenario. So he went into that Ashes campaign, if I recall correctly, off the back of a MVP performance in the IPL, and then had a shocking Ashes, then went back to the IPL and bossed it again, and then was back to the domineering best across formats. He can do it again. A change of scene, a change of mindset, a change of everything. West Indies might help, you know, just going nice calm shores and not too much watching him. It might be what he needs just to get back to what he needs to be. Because if Joss Butler isn't the player that we know he can be, then that has such a huge bearing on the team that England can be, because he is the best white ball player we've ever produced. And if his form is so far short of where it should be, even as a base level not very great tournament, you'd expect him to be batting at more than the run of ball and averaging more than 13. It's like, you know, yeah. either or both would be ideal, but neither is unsustainable.
I think the two things to say on that, I remember Michael Vaughan telling me once that during the 2005 Ashes, he used to debrief with Mark Nicholas at the end of every day's play, just send him a text or whatever, and ask him how they looked in the field. And his point was that he wanted to purvey strong body language regardless of the situation. And he also said that one of the things he learned, or he was told by I think one of his friends or one of his associates or something like that, was just make sure your eyes are always above the advertising hoardings, so they can never get a shot of you just looking down, looking a bit lost.
Yeah.
The other thing to say, I think we're probably going to talk about the ODI squad that they picked for the Caribbean soon enough. But I think one of the things that will help Butler with that group of players is that a lot of them, A, haven't played a lot of cricket with him, and B, grown up idolising him.
Yeah.
They will come in there and think, holy shit, that's Joss Butler. How cool is this? And I think that might pump up his stars a bit and be quite a nice way to close out what has been quite a challenging year, because I think it's one thing having this group now where it was a group of mates, slowly one or two players move out of the way, then you basically lose the older brother in Owen Morgan, and suddenly, you know, a new leadership figure comes in there. But I think this will have an altogether different feel of it, and, you know, that adulation will respond to, I want to play for him, I want to do this, that and the other. And who knows, we might see another Joss Butler because of it.
And just worth also pointing out, just because we've been talking around it, but it is actually the 1 year anniversary since England won the T20 World Cup today, which just goes to show how quickly things change. Last year, literally a year ago, Joss Butler and Matthew Mott, to be fair, were parading around the MCG English cricket with double world champions, and everything was rosy. I mean, it is ridiculous how quickly that narrative has changed, but equally, it goes to show how quickly it can yet be reinvigorated ahead of their defence of the T20 title in June. I mean, that's still 9 months away, or 8 months away, so they've got a chance if they can just get into the headspace, because mindset is everything in where this team is at. That's why they play so much golf, because they can get their heads away from the actual worrying about the game and just smack it.
We won't go into whether all that golf was a good thing or not. I mean, we certainly wouldn't have, when we were talking beforehand, Butler averaging 15 for the tournament, 138 runs from 9 innings. No one would have envisaged that he would have gone on that sort of run. His record as captain, just looking back, going into this tournament, his average as captain was higher. It's now lower because of that run of form. It certainly looked as if he had the weight of the world on his shoulders come the sort of the back end of the campaign. Some of the other missteps England made, I mean, around, let's say, the contracts announcement or even seemingly not being so fussed that they were officially out of the tournament that they put up Carl Hopkinson as for the presser after the Australia game. Those are sort of more foreseeable errors or misjudgments, I suppose, Miller. But there really were just almost innumerable kind of things that went wrong. Everything that could go wrong went wrong. I mean, Joe Root averaged 30, barely got out the power play when he went in. And he was England's third best batter behind David Milan and Ben Stokes. And I suppose what we're coming to is really that this is likely the end of the road for a lot of those guys in one day ODI cricket or white ball internationals altogether for England.
Yeah, I mean, Joe Root, we talked about him last pod, but I mean, I reiterate what I said then. I of all the people to lose form, he is the most bewildering. I mean, we've seen Joss Butler lose form before. We've seen him just not in the right space to do what he does. I've never seen Joe Root in the wrong space to do what he does. He's never, ever been so far off the pace. He looks as though he's burgling a career in white ball cricket at the minute. I mean, it really does. I mean, you know, two 50s at the start of the tournament, one at the end. They do not mitigate the disaster in between. I mean, as you mentioned, 11 dismissals in 19 power play innings since the last World Cup. And as we've said already, I personally think his problems in white ball cricket stem from that World Cup finals. His 7 from 30 balls was a weirdly out of kilter performance, and he's never quite found his tempo since. So that's a concern. You touched on the contracts there as well, and again, he's got a 3-year contract. He's one of the few, along with Mark Wood and Harry Brook, who, as we said, is the good news coming out of that going forward. But I mean, what are you going to do with a 3-year contract for Joe Root if the weight of player coming through? You know, Vish talks about how these guys are going to go out to the Caribbean and look at Joss Butler and say, "I'm going to impress you, Skip." I mean, there are so many players out there who will see this as their chance. It's like 2015 all over again, but it's slightly different for England because obviously the landscape around us has changed. It's not quite as simple as just saying, you know what, we're playing the wrong brand of cricket here, bin off everyone who is rubbish and bring in the kids who are gagging for it. England have been handing out contracts like confetti to all of their star players because they want to pin them down. They can't afford to lose the likes of Root, Stokes, Wood, all these icons of their 2019 and their test adventures. You can't let them go to the free market. They're not confident enough that they'll come back again if they're sent off to ply their own way in an ever-changing landscape. So it's a really difficult balance to strike, trying to create a new vibe, a new 2015 blank slate. It's not an option at the moment because you can't just have a blank slate with it, with this caliber of icon. England didn't have that caliber of icon. They'd been hidden behind a paywall for decades since 2005. Their most iconic player was Alistair Cook, who was binned before the World Cup. I mean, it's just not an option.
Filling Ian Bell's shoes, you know, took a lot.
Yeah, it's a different dynamic, and you know, the speed with which things have changed, I feel as though it accelerated even this tournament. Actually, when you know, obviously we got the news of Mo Bobat leaving to go to the IPL. I mean, that's a huge indictment of where the ECB are at the moment. That even the guy who seemingly is the puppet master behind the scenes, manipulating all these kids coming up through the pathways, and he's saying, yeah, you know what, the grass is greener over there. I mean, that's a huge indictment of where the ECB are at as an organisation and where international cricket is at. And so in terms of rebuilding from that level of distrust in the product is a challenge, and you know, it's going to get harder next summer. We haven't even touched on we got West Indies didn't even make this tournament. Sri Lanka had an even worse tournament than England, still beat them, and they're the two marquee tourists next summer. It's not a very healthy scenario for English cricket henceforth, and so rebuilding from there, it's going to be really complicated. You can't do it without pinning your hopes on the likes of Root, Stokes, Butler, Wood, but equally on the evidence we've seen this tournament, you also have to.
Yeah, I mean, the contract situation, Vish, when we were looking at talking about this sort of the wrangling between the international schedule and T20 franchise leagues and so on for quite a while now, but it kind of looked like how England have grasped this is quite, it's a masterstroke. They're going to pin players down, you know, more security, you know, keeping the primacy of the international game. And then about a fortnight later, it's beginning to look like, hang on, why have you given a 3-year contract to Mark Wood? But, I mean, that is, Miller's touched on it there, but you've got Adil Rashid is 35, I think, has a 2-year contract, doesn't play Red Bull cricket, will go to the T20 World Cup, isn't playing the ODIs in the Caribbean, but is contracted for the next 2 years. So you'd think is going to be involved. Chris Wokes has a 2-year contract, only really plays tests at home, is a T20 World Cup winner, but you know, arguably doesn't have the strongest grip on his place in that format and might not play ODIs again. It's beginning to look like this hasn't been fully thought through. You praised Rob Key's approach to the job so far, but is this one going to, you know, be something that in 12 months or more down the line, we're going to be like, what were England doing here?
I mean, it already does feel like that a little bit, doesn't it? Do you think they're wondering if they're, well, looking back through the fine print and see, do we put a probational period on that?
Or? David Milan has a contract and has been dropped from both of the formats that he played.
Yeah, it's great work if you can get it. it is a strange one. It felt like they had to move, and because of when the previous cycle contracts were up, that being the end of September, then they had to put something in place then. I think a lot of the reason it spilled over was because of the wranglings around the years, you know, the terms of the contract, the actual, you know, time length of the contract rather than, you know, the personnel. I'm trying to think where I was at the time. Probably the middle of September was when I understood that everyone who was going to get a contract knew they were going to get a contract. And there were two points of contention. One was David Willey, the other was Will Jacks. And it sounded like Will Jacks was probably a little bit closer than David Willey was. But they, you know, they decided not to go with Jacks. And obviously they'd already made that decision on Willey. And I think he'd already said his piece behind closed doors, as he reiterated, and Key reiterated when they're out in India. It is a fascinating one, because I suppose we've seen it before in Test cricket. We were talking about it earlier on in the office. We've seen it before in Test cricket where someone gets dropped after the Ashes and then they sit on a central contract for 9 months, 10 months even, until they're eventually taken off the list. And I suppose because of the song and dance that has been made about this particular agreement, this breakthrough period of multi-year contracts, even the year contracts in themselves look particularly foolish, and David Milan being one of them.
Key said, who obviously did his briefing, he said David Milan is definitely not dropped, and you know, not going to play the T20 World Cup. But
I mean, yeah. you look.
But you would have to say that if you just given him a year long contract.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. but I suppose you can. Do you remember that Chelsea Dutch defender Winston Bogaerts?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Sat on 40 grand a week.
How many minutes did he play?
whatever it was. But yeah, David Milan might be in that situation, although not quite on the same money. But you know, David Milan will be in a shout, you know, for that T20 World Cup. So that kind of makes sense. But also at the same time, even if David Milan goes on that T20 World Cup, he might turn around at the end of the tournament and be like, right, that's me. I'm going to do what Jason Roy did last year and. Can this, if he can get
he's not going to fly back from the Caribbean, he's just going to go straight over to...
Yeah, he's going to shuffle over while I'm in the country. Yeah. You know, if anyone fancies a ringer, the Seattle Orcas.
Yeah. That is a genuine name.
Yeah, it is, yeah, yeah. I thought that was a bit there, but no, I've accidentally stumbled on one. I suppose next year is the big year, though, isn't it? And maybe in that regard, that will be a bit of a get-out-of-jail card for them, because obviously there's going to be a new MOU with... PCA, TEP, and the ECB. There's going to be a new broadcast deal on the table of sorts. So they'll have A, more money to play with, and B, a better idea of what they have and, you know, who they want to give these contracts to. And obviously, you know, the big one is Ben Stokes, only signing a year. So he kind of...
Whether they still want to keep him involved at all.
Yes, yeah, potentially. We'll see how this new knee turns out. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I suppose that's fair. You could say that this was a blight, but I felt like everyone was in agreement that it was something that had to happen. Bear in mind, Richard Gould was talking about this in at the start of the summer. It was referenced in Pakistan in December of 2022.
Yeah.
So this has always been moving forward. Originally the conversation started around match fees, and then that got kiboshed because they were going to go towards these, handing out a few more multi-year deals. Could have been handled better. I don't really know, because it feels like this was always going to be the hardest bit. Getting them off the ground was going to be the hardest bit, and it's probably going to be clean for the next two cycles. But it's just awkward that, yeah, as you say, within 2 weeks of them, you know, ink's not even dry, and already you're wondering if you should take a few back.
Yeah, I mean, it's not unlike England's World Cup campaign in itself. It's like it felt a no-brainer. It felt like the right way to do it in a difficult, changing landscape. It was right to trust the team, the guys who'd been there before. It was right to give contracts to the guys who'd been there before. Different sides of the same coin, as far as I'm concerned. It's like England had to put their faith in what they knew in terms of this team that had won everything that had been put before it and looked well enough adjusted to at least put in a performance this time around. It seemed like the logical thing to do. And as Matt was saying last time out, it's like it's not as if they decided it midway through the tournament. This was all decided in September. So, you know, David Willey knew before he got on the plane that he didn't have a contract and hence was just debating whether to get on the plane in the first place, which obviously is a factor that would have destabilised the squad. It's not like the closed shop mind of Basball, where you know you pick your team, you don't waver from trusting every facet of that team through thick and thin. It's like England got out to India with some guys being visibly valued more than others, and that surely is a seed of discontent among professional sportsmen who've, you know, let's be honest, you're in it for the glory, but you're also in it for the money, and that's almost certainly going to cause division if people don't feel like they're all being treated equally.
I mean, there is some take the view that actually, you know, giving say Harry Brook is a young sportsman hungry to win internationals and so on, giving him a 3-year contract, that's a bit of a safety net. You know, I think, I don't want to put words into or make up a Michael Vaughan column that didn't exist. I'm sure someone of that ilk said, you know, you should be keeping these players hungry to play for England, not saying, oh, you're on the team, you're in the team for the next 3 years, basically.
But specifically on Harry Brook, I don't think they would have dulled his enthusiasm to play for England by giving him more security. I get the point. And it feels like English cricket has existed, you know, with this particular relationship around central contracts long enough that, you know, I suppose it's worked. I think this is a different way of doing things. And it's almost, to be fair, if you look at, for example, the ILT20, when it started, you know, a lot of money, they clearly hadn't really thought it through, which is why they had to go from a draft to just recruiting players to fill the numbers, which is why you ended up with teams with a lot of English players in them just to make up the numbers. Now, obviously, for example, there are ICC regulations that are mooted to come in, whereby, you know, you're not necessarily fulfilling the criteria of a UAE tournament, as it were. You need more locals in it, this, that, and the other. You don't necessarily know if that's going to be around in 3 years' time, but also it could well be, and there could be more. More tournaments of that ilk around the world, and therefore I suppose that's what they're banking on with giving Brook 3 years. You're one of the most sought after young players in the world. Your name's going to be even bigger in 2 years' time, a year's time. Why don't we just lock you down for 3 years? That kind of makes sense. It seems to suit both parties.
It doesn't mean they're going to pick him in 11, as he found out.
And I think, and this is a bit of a tangent, but I think one of the interesting things I found about this World Cup, and I suppose it also feeds into the idea that, like, Mott and Butler had somehow lost control of the dressing room, this and the other, which was overblown. And I think it was shown in the fact that, yes, they could have picked, as soon as they're out, they could have gone Cast, Brook, Atkinson, in you go, here, have a look at the future for World Cup experience. But actually, it sounds like the senior players kind of got around it a bit and thought, you know what, we've messed up here, we're going to just take ownership of this. you know, let us see it out. Don't, you know, why throw them into this kind of lose-lose situation? We can see it through. And you know, fair enough for that. But I suppose to go back to the original point, I don't think it takes away anything from, you know, from Brook or particular. I suppose Root is the one where it's like, do you really need to secure him for that long? But I don't necessarily see that with Brook.
But it is interesting though, just to go into the dynamics and the discussions that are going to be had. And as you say, the new deal in 24 will be fascinating, especially because, you know, reappraise the 1 year contracts, if not the 2 or 3 year contracts. But I mean, already my solution would be to almost trust the market. I think you've got to trust, I think with the way the game is fragmenting, you've got to trust that players want to play for England. You've got to trust that international cricket is valued by the players who will make money elsewhere on the franchise circuit, but when push comes to shove, they will want to come back and play for England. And so instead of bolting them down to these 3 year deals that requires them to turn out for tedious bilateral games, just pay more per game. Put your ECB's money into match fees for England appearances or England squad selections, because then you don't end up with people missing out if they're a 12th man. But that way you are reinforcing the importance of international cricket while at the same time acknowledging that the game is fragmenting, and if you're going to float off to play the ILT20 or whatever it is, it's really hard to say no to you. I mean, I was thinking about this in terms of football, where, you know, increasingly the sport, cricket, is heading towards a world much like football, where the club game is dominant, but it doesn't mean that the international game is any less important. I mean, obviously it is for tedious friendlies and rubbish qualifying events, but when it comes to the main event, the world stops for the World Cup and the Euros. And also, in terms of trusting the market, look at what's happened in this last cycle. Obviously, Vish would know this better than me because I don't know much about football, but I do know that Jude Bellingham and Harry Kane have been liberated by the market. They've gone off to play for the best teams they possibly can. And in so doing, they've found form that has probably made England a much better bet to win glory. So in terms of letting players loose, trusting that they will fly away, spread their wings, much as they did in 2015 when England finally realised that the IPL was not a threat, the IPL was an opportunity to train them up. It almost feels as though England need to go even further with that. The World Game needs to go further with that. We touched on, you know, New Zealand. They're in the semi-finals yet again. And New Zealand had Trent Bolt not playing for a year because he turned down a contract. But when it came to, when push comes to shove, back he comes for the main event and he produces a performance that merits their qualification in the top four. It feels as though that's where the game has got to go. And as you say, England have locked into this cycle by going down the central contract route. I just wonder whether they will need to think long and hard about where the market is. And if English cricket is not necessarily the most sought after market on the global stage anymore, India clearly is. And therefore, you need to trust that we can be a better team by trusting that market.
One of the fears, I suppose, that we've talked about plenty was that in the footballisation of cricket, the cricket landscape is IPL teams in the main contracting players year round and then having to be, you know, released in order to play for England.
I suppose that's where an MOU would come in, wouldn't it? You'd have to, it would require India to take the lead. But India, even India, I mean, see the importance of the World Cup to India. They value international cricket because they desperately want to win this tournament. And so if India wanted to include an MOU that says, you know what, we are going to allow players to play X number of games a year, including the ICC event, which by the looks of it are going to be every year now. With the return of the Champions Trophy is proof that the ICC have put their stake in the ground, saying every year we're going to have an event that the world is going to congregate around. And good for that, I say, because the more ICC events there are, the more the international game will have something to stick its hat on, rather than relying on, as I say, ropey Sri Lanka and West Indies teams coming over to get basballed next summer, which frankly I don't think is going to be particularly attractive.
I thought about this a while ago and I couldn't quite flesh it out because it felt like there might have been too many moving parts. But if you use the All Blacks rugby union team as an example, they have a criteria you need to sort, if you want to be eligible for selection for the All Blacks, and that is basically to play your rugby in the kind of in the conversation they have with South Africa and Australia.
It's a Super Tri Nations now. Well, it's not anymore.
No, but it's like the Super 15s, isn't it? It's you know, their club, their club, like yes, Champions League yeah. type thing.
We're off into a third sport here. Where we're,
yes, know. I know. I realise that.
But grasping for expertise.
This is the best example of it.
Yeah.
And so to be eligible for a World Cup, you need to play in that competition leading up to the World Cup. But obviously, there's a period at the start of the next cycle where they let their players do what they want. So you know, Dan Carter, their famous fire half, is playing in France. And I know, you know, a lot of players went to play in France where they could earn a bit more money, but they had to basically be back for a certain time. No, obviously
they got like hall passes
to a point. Yeah. And I wondered if maybe English cricket could operate like that, where it wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't be seen as the end of the world to give your wares to others and make sure, you know, that criteria might be, it wouldn't necessarily be for years, but that criteria might be right. So after the IPL, we've got a big test series coming up here. You need to have played three rounds of the county championship before. If you want to be eligible for that, we need to see X number of Red Bull games in a particular period. And you might get that if you're a Ben Stokes, where you're playing, you know, you don't really play Red Bull cricket for Durham anyway. But for someone else, maybe like a Will Jacks, you know, you've got to be like, right, you've got to play these two games for Surrey. And I suppose, you know, to flip reverse it, if an IPL team did get a Ben Stokes, they know that Ben Stokes is, you know, never is more prominent than when he's playing for England, whether it's in a World Cup, whether it's in the Ashes. And so it's also in their interest to, you know, to let them go on. So, I mean, it's funny because I think England were probably too spooked by the pullouts for the Bangladesh series, which on paper made total sense to me. Why would you as a cricketer go and, you know, just keep the seat warm for someone else? It was essentially they picked a third 11 squad, and it just so happened that those players were in their 30s and all had, you know, PSL gigs essentially. And you can understand why they wanted to miss out on that. Or players who just outright refused because they wanted to keep themselves fresh for the IPL because they knew they weren't first choice. Now, obviously, you know, that in
the pride of the badge on the shirt, Vish.
Yeah, no,
what are you
course.
Telling
yeah,
us?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. God save the king, even. But I think maybe they extrapolated that too far. I think you could really see, even on an individual case-by-case basis, why those players had made that decision rather than the collective, oh, this is, you know, franchise cricket is already encroaching here. And obviously it made headlines, and it's a catchier headline than, you know, for example, X player wants to keep himself fresh for the IPL. But, I do wonder. As Miller says, like, kind of play what's in front of you. We're going to play the situation as it is right now. But I mean, at the same time, I'm being a bit of a hypocrite there because I thought the, and still do think the contracts are a good idea, the multi-year deals.
I think the contract, I don't disagree there is a logic to them. I just think that in this particular juncture where the greatest asset that English cricket has is, I think, is not so much the fact it's got a bunch of proven superstars who have done their thing. It's the fact that they've got a wealth of talent, particularly in white ball cricket, but across the game, thanks to the county system, and the fact that there is a professional structure that stretches across the country, that there is such a groundswell of contenders. And the problem with these contracts is you are going to suppress the contenders if you feel obliged to keep picking players who have proven themselves already, but have nothing left to prove. Harry Brook, I mean, case in point, Harry Brook is... I do agree that there is a danger that Harry Brook will not be as hungry as he would be if he was Will Jacks right this minute. He's a young kid being paid an awful lot of money to go through the motions, as opposed to a young kid who really, really, really wants to prove his point, just as he did when he got left out of that World Cup and then produced a run of form that made him absolutely a no-brainer. So, you know, there are a whole load of guys who are going to be competing to replace a bunch of legends in the coming months. And I just fear that the contract situation will cloud the situation. England have put an awful lot of money. They've got a lot of outlay on a bunch of players who probably, when push comes to shove, are over the hill already.
Well, there's always a bright new bilateral dawn around the corner. A lot of the legends are on their way. David Willey has retired and goes out with his final act being taking his 100th ODI wicket, which was a nice way to finish for him, certainly after not getting one of these contracts we've been talking about. England head off to the Caribbean in just a couple of weeks, pretty much. The schedule never sleeps. Three ODIs, five T20Is in the lead up to Christmas. Joss Butler's still the captain. Six survivors from the World Cup squad to play the ODIs. So that's Butler, Gus Atkinson, Harry Brook, Brian Cast, Sam Curran, and Liam Livingston. And then some well, not new faces, certainly in the case of Ollie Pope, who is uncapped in white ball formats, but we know all about him as a test batter. Josh Tung has played test cricket. John Turner was in, I think, one of the T20 squads last summer before getting injured.
Yep.
But this is the chance, isn't it, for the regeneration that perhaps maybe, with hindsight, should have been taking place a couple of years ago. People like Rehan Ahmed, Zach Crawley, Phil Salt, and so on, staking their claims. Mainly, or at least in you know, for the ODI setup, there's that Champions Trophy that we're going to, and then the 2027 World Cup. The T20 squad is a bit more familiar. People like Moeen Ali and Adil Rashid, who will be expected to sort of try and defend that crown in the USA and Caribbean next year. But yeah, I mean, there's now a whole new load of kind of a lot more riding on this tour, Vish, than there seemed to be when we were looking at the schedule before this World Cup.
Yeah, it's quite funny, actually, because you mentioned Ollie Pope there at the start, and Ollie Pope was always going on this tour because, you know, in his recovery from his shoulder injury picked up during the Ashes, this was the only competitive cricket he would be able to get between, you know, the end of the summer and the start of the India Test Series in the year. And now it's gone from, oh, you know, have a go out there, have a hit, to, right, you are the future now. You're going to play more ODI cricket. Yeah. And it's kind of worked well for him. Zach Crawley is another one who he finished the Test summer with a view to basically getting a franchise gig so that he could play some cricket between now and now in India. Now he's caught up to this, which will supersede that because of his contract and whatnot. So, yeah, it's quite an interesting thing because I feel like we spoke, there was that generation of test player, I suppose, and I'll throw Ben Folkes in there as well, who haven't really played much, you know, white ball cricket full stop. Probably played a bit more than some of the younger players, but in terms of 50 over cricket. But because they were playing test cricket, were actually almost blocked off from playing ODI cricket. Maybe Ben Duckett is another good example of that. And it was a bit of a surprise that he wasn't talked up as much for this World Cup squad, actually. So it's an opportunity for them to really, you know, state their case. And it feels like, as Miller alluded to before, the way England are playing their test cricket is much more closely aligned to certainly the ODI cricket they should have been playing over the last 6 weeks than, say, the T20 cricket they've played over the last 2 years. So yeah, we're in a fascinating point in time here, and I think also, you know, further forward, we talked about captaincy. We didn't really see it. There was no kind of viable contender to challenge Joss Butler for the armband, as it were, from the current crop. But we might end up seeing someone coming to the fore who shows a bit of pluck, shows a bit of something extra that might lend itself to just general leadership, actually, as well, because why not? Let's throw in the test captaincy with this as well, because who knows how much longer Ben Stokes has got physically, or how long he'd want to do it. But generally, you know, that's something that we might be having a serious conversation about that in a year's time. And so someone like Pope, who is test vice-captain, someone like Zach Crawley, who captained the Ireland series, and obviously it was punctuated by rain, but actually was pretty impressive, all told. That is, you know, I suppose another narrative around this series as well. So, yeah, it's gone from a bit of an afterthought to suddenly the most important thing on the horizon.
Yeah, it's interesting as well. Just you say there that all these guys have been blocked off from white ball cricket. I mean, that almost felt at the time like a conscious decision when England were a dominant white ball team that had stability and a bubble that clearly was not going to get penetrated. the only outlet for the best young talent in English cricket was to weave their way into the Test team. And remember that period in when just before the pandemic, when we were out in South Africa and England won in Port Elizabeth, when Ollie Pope got his first 100, didn't he? And there was that team, I think Don Bess and Sam Curran and Crawley as well, wasn't it? There were a load of guys aged 21 or under who were visibly the future of English cricket, who had been given an opportunity as red ball players because even by then the white ball team was completely locked off. So it's and I suppose the other interesting facet, going back to what we talked about at the start, is that, you know, Test virtues are more relevant to the 50 over format than perhaps we had remembered. And so, you know, these merits that these guys have developed, particularly through Bazball, but just you know, the duration, the pacing of a long innings, is something that will probably stand them in good stead in the 50 over format, albeit there's barely any 50 over cricket after this tour for them to get their teeth into, and who knows what's going to happen with the Champions Trophy. There's talk of it turning into a T20 tournament, so it may be they'll have to put all those virtues on the back burner till 2027, but at least they've got them, which is more than can be said for some of the players who perhaps have been T20 only in the interim, because again, that lack of opportunity to break into the England setup has created a logjam. It's an awkward, an eternal balancing act that England are going to have to strike quite firmly in the coming years.
Bazball will save us, of course, in the dictionary now. So, tune in for more neologisms in future editions. There was no Sam Hain in this ODI squad. Vish, were you as indignant as Edgbaston groundsman Gary Barwell was?
What did he say?
He tweeted about it.
Wow. Okay.
I don't normally tweet about cricket, but
yes, I suppose the issue being that if you've got Joss there, if you've got Pope there, that it does make sense. Do you need to take him away from the BBL? Probably not. Can you take him away from the BBL, given that you don't necessarily have...
He's not got a three-year contract.
Yeah. I think Sam Hain will be all right. He'll definitely be... This is the quite exciting bit of this, is that we're going to be in a situation where actually, you know, there are a lot of open spots. The only impediment to that is, as Miller says, they're not going to play much ODI cricket beyond this series until Australia at the end of the 2024
Super
summer?
September.
Super September, yeah.
You're not going to play any List A cricket, not going to play the One Day Cup either.
We'll
be having this conversation again about the structure of the calendar.
Yeah, but we'll be back to bin 50 over cricket. it's tough, but I think they can't just look for kids, can they? This is a very different situation now. These players who are in their mid-20s have grown up in an environment where they've been asked to push the envelope in white ball cricket, take more risks. And though Hain isn't the most destructive one-day player, I mean, obviously a very destructive T20 player, but he's not like a 130 strike rate, 50 over player. He is the good Joe Root alike, isn't he, in terms of holding things together? And we saw that against Ireland, and I think his time will come. But I feel sad for him and Gary Barnwell, but I mean, it kind of makes sense, yeah.
The World Cup semi-finals this week, Miller. Not that England will have any skin in the game, but who's going to come second to India?
Well, I mean, it's increasingly looking like Australia, isn't it? I mean, I will reiterate, my call before the World Cup was they wouldn't get to the semis. I stand by my reasoning, because for two games early in the tournament, they played down to every one of the expectations I thought they would play down to. They were too reliant on the tempo set by Smith and Labuschagne in the middle. They didn't have the explosiveness required to close out the game, and suddenly
that's
changed.
If only they trust that Glenn Maxwell fella.
If only they trust that Glenn Maxwell. I mean, who you heard it here first, but lo and behold, it happened. But, you know, the way they've come together has been ominous and very Australian. They've, you know, their opening partnership, I didn't think that Warner had another World Cup in him. I thought he was going to bomb, so fair play to him for going out on high. Travis Head coming back into the side has just provided an extra spark at the top, and Mitchell Marsh has had an absolute stormer. I mean, in the way Ashes legend Mitchell Marsh, he's taken his neutralising a Baz ball into a new realm, and has taken that on as a gun number three, and obviously their bowling attack with Zampa, who was potentially looked like he could be isolated early in the tournament, looked like, you know, if a confident England would have targeted
confident
Zampa.
Joss Butler.
Confident Joss Butler would have taken Zampa to the cleaners instead of an unconfident Joss Butler tapped into mid-off. I mean, it's, you know, Zampa has bowled magnificently, just accurate and with variation and nous. They look like a team who are on the rise, whereas poor old South Africa look like a team who are so nearly nailing it. But I just wonder if they will feel as though they peaked too soon. It just, you know, they've got Heinrich Klassen came into the World Cup and produced that innings at Mumbai. He came into the World Cup as the best player in the world and lived up to it with an absolute all-time innings. But then suddenly, you got Glenn Maxwell trumping even Heinrich Klassen's best with the greatest World Cup, greatest ODI innings ever seen. It just feels as though another heartbreak is around the corner for South Africa.
You think they're going to party like it's 1999?
Well, exactly. I mean, 1999 was the greatest low-scoring ODI ever witnessed. This could be the greatest high-scoring ODI ever witnessed if these two teams duke it out in the way that they're batting. Threatens, they could, but I, you know, a bit like that Gary Lineker quote. You watch all the team duke it out, and then Germany win on penalties or whatever it is. It's Australia win in the end, don't they? that's kind of how it pans out.
Unless India do, Vish, are we going to get? We've had, you know, 6 weeks, 5.5 weeks to get to this point. Three good games from here.
Definitely one. I do worry that New Zealand have basically had an inverse England of a World Cup group stages where, you know, they seem to have fallen away a little bit. But, yeah, I just can't see past India. And the worst thing is India losing the semi-final against New Zealand will, I think we can all agree, will be the funniest outcome. But it would be funny because it actually looks impossible. I mean, they just have every base covered and it's, you know, a lot of people talking about this World Cup for entertainment's sake and that it's dragging on. I think the thing that has exacerbated that feeling that it's just going on and on and on is that we rocked up knowing who the winners would be and they've just proved it every step of the way.
They've won nine in a row.
Yeah, I mean, it
two
would...
Two more to knock off.
I mean, it'd be great. Not least because if New Zealand end up doing the unthinkable and beating India, they'll have done so with the similar average age to England, who apparently were over the hill. So,
yeah. Well, two things. I was talking to Fidel about this on Stump Mike podcast, and of all the teams that India could face in these knockouts, New Zealand is the last team they'd want to face simply because they cover off every base that India do not. They go into every game with absolutely no expectations and outperform themselves, whereas India go in with absolutely ramped up expectations, and so far they've lived up to them. But there's going to be that seed of doubt. It's like, you know, they did it to us in 2019. They did it to us in the World Test Championship final. Of all the teams that India could face, a team that has absolutely no expectations and has more sheep than people is probably the kryptonite that a superstars team would not want to face. That said, I still think they'll steamroll them. But if they don't, we'll have yet more evidence of a good little one can always beat a good big one.
Well, quite. So the world beaters in sheep's clothing, that's what we're after.
I mean, people will point to the 2019 semi-final, but you do have to remember that did play out over 2 days. So unless we got something similar, don't know.
Well, we can certainly agree it'll be very funny if it happens. That is your lot for today. England's run as ODI World Champs is over. Let's be honest, it made us feel a bit uncomfortable, didn't it? The tournament concludes in Ahmedabad on Sunday with everyone hoping India make it to the final, else there's going to be a lot of empty seats. England will be off to the Caribbean soon, and we'll be back to judge them from afar. Until then, my thanks to Miller and Vish, and to you all for tuning in to the Switch It podcast on ESPNcricketinfo.com.